Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Longtime NPR and ABC political commentator and former congressional correspondent Cokie Roberts has died. She was in broadcasting for more than 50 years, sharing her political expertise with listeners around the country and inspiring young female broadcasters in the process. Cokie was a multi-Emmy Award winner, one of the 50 greatest women in the history of broadcasting, according to American Women in Radio and Television, and the Library of Congress named her a living legend, a very rare honor. She wrote many books about women in American history, including one we talked to her about just a few years ago, Founding Mothers. We remember Cokie Roberts by revisiting that conversation this hour. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Everyone acknowledges the contributions of the hundreds of thousands of Rosie the Riveters during World War II. Those women played an essential part in our war effort and set the stage for the role of women in the workplace today. But women made important contributions to the country from our very beginnings. You just haven't heard much about them. So several years ago, Cokie Roberts set out to correct that. She wrote Founding Mothers, The Women Who Raised Our Nation. It's a valuable book for adults, but most of us learned the contributions of the Founding Fathers early in our education. Even before that first day of school, mothers and fathers have been known to cite the example of George Washington's inability to tell a lie about chopping down that cherry tree. So why wait until you're old enough to read Cokie Roberts' 300-page book to learn about the Founding Mothers? Well, now you don't have to, because she's written an illustrated version for children called Founding Mothers, Remembering the Ladies. And NPR's Cokie Roberts joins us for the hour to talk about these women and that what they have meant to the country. Welcome back to the program.
So nice to be with you, Mike. Thank you.
You're very welcome. People who haven't read either of your books on the Founding Mothers might just surmise that these women just stayed home, cared for the house, the children, cooked, sewed, which, given the times, was certainly hard enough. But you quote General Lord Cornwallis as saying, "We may destroy all the men in America, and we shall still have to do all we can to defeat the women." That's a very telling statement.
It is. Isn't it wonderful? I love the fact that the greatest compliment came from the enemy. but it's true. I think it's fair to say that the Founding Fathers really couldn't have done what they did if the women in their lives didn't do what they did. And it was everything from supporting the family while the men were off at Congress and war and diplomatic missions not making any money, to being propagandist for the cause, to being on the battlefield. So there were lots of roles that women played throughout our history, obviously, but in this crucial founding period, they played very crucial roles.
And Lord Cornwallis recognized that, as did several other people that we'll hear about as we go through the hour. But why has it taken over 200 years for someone to get around to recognizing them?
Well, what a depressing question. it's because people didn't value women's contributions or think that women mattered. And look, you know, their names are not on the Declaration of Independence or the Constitution. They were not the generals on the battlefields. So it's easy to see why that is the case. I've had the great fun of talking to a lot of kids since the kids' book came out, and I go into these, you know, schoolrooms, and I say, all those pictures of the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution and all of that, is anything missing? And the boys always come up with something just weird, you know. Well, there's some symbol that should be there. What are you talking about, right? But then some little girl will finally raise her hand and say, "Women, there are no women in those pictures." And the truth is, you can learn history without knowing that women even exist. And of course, that's such a distorted view of the world and of history.
And that's because, traditionally at least, men have written the history books.
Well, that's part of it. That's certainly a big part of it. But also, we sort of went through this interesting period, Mike, where after World War II with the GI Bill and all of that, people started writing a lot more about everyday Americans, not the elite founders. And so what happened was you did get stories about midwives and you got very valuable slave narratives, things like that. But there was this gap where no one had really written about the women who were the women who influenced the founding fathers. Mm-hmm. And in recent times, of course, we've had a whole spate of new, terrific books about the founders. You know, Washington and Jefferson and Adams all have had new biographies within the last 10 years. So it's really been a wonderful revisiting of the history. But again, it went on for a very long time without any mention of the women. And I think that that is just such a serious lack.
Despite all that, your two books about the founding mothers are not really the first.
They're actually three.
Okay.
Yes, because the Founding Mothers, the grown-up version, mm-hmm. came out in 2004, and that starts with the lead-up to the Revolution and ends with the inauguration of John Adams, which was the first peaceful transfer of government in democratic society. And then the next book, Ladies of Liberty, which came out in 2008, goes from Adams to Adams. So it goes to the inauguration of John Quincy Adams, which is literally the next generation.
And as I was about to say, these three books that you wrote are not really the first. You reference one that goes way back, and there have been a few others going back, I think, a couple of centuries, actually.
Right. So there were some 19th century biographies. There were even some tidbits written in the 18th century, but 19th century biographies. But you can't count on them, Mike. You know, they tend to be very flowery and they're not sourced, so you have to sort of you have to use them for what they are, and they do often have some letters in them, and descendants of some of these women did collect their letters. So if we have their actual letters, then we're in good shape, you know. But but you can't count on the early biographies because they are kind of lives of the saints, which is, you know, fine with me. I'm happy to make them saints, but I'd like them to be more flesh and blood.
Yeah. How did you do whatever primary research you could do, given the lack of a lot of written material in some cases?
Yeah, it was detective work, but particularly for the first book, for Founding Mothers, because, to be completely honest, the scholars at historic societies and at universities and libraries like the Library of Congress tended to look down their noses at a mere journalist, right? So I had to, as one historian later told me, well, that book was your dissertation, you know. But, so I had to really ferret out a lot of the materials, but some were easy. Some, as I say, some descendants had published the letters. Some historic societies were helpful, like the South Carolina Historic Society and the Massachusetts Historic Society. And then you would find clues in the men's letters that there were some women's letters drifting around someplace. And that was what you had to do.
So are you saying, let's back up a little bit, are you saying that scholars put up roadblocks to a mere journalist because they didn't trust you or they didn't want you to write the definitive book on the Founding Mothers?
They just think that I know this comes as a shock to you, Mike, but they think that we're dilettantes. But when the book came out with page after page after page of footnotes, they caught on. And so then everybody was incredibly helpful when it came to writing Ladies of Liberty because they realized that this was useful work.
So how long did it take you to do those first two books, the research for those
first
two
books? I would say, Steve and I had a book on marriage come out in 2000, so mm-hmm. I must have started the research right after that. And so from 2000 to 2008, which was when Ladies of Liberty came out. So, you know, a long time.
Yeah, a long time. And in that time, you were also working at NPR.
Yeah,
you were also
working
at ABC.
Right. I had several day jobs.
Yes. And after all of that research, and after writing these two first books, and now the third one for children, you say, in the introduction to The Women Who Raised Our Nation, that there was nothing unique about these women. Explain that.
Well, I think that we tend to put the whole era on a pedestal. You know, we see the founding fathers as bronze and marble statues. And yes, they were extraordinary men, but I think it's much more important to understand that they were men. And it's much harder to do the extraordinary things that they did when you are a flesh and blood human being. You're not a marble or bronze deity. And I think that the same is true of the women, that they, yes, they lived through difficult, very times that required great sacrifice and that where they suffered great hardships. And as you said earlier, just getting through the day in the 18th century was hard. But what they did was extraordinary, but they, again, were regular people. And they did what I think most women do, which is that they put one foot in front of the other and they carried on in order to make things work. And they did it with just remarkable courage and skill.
You said earlier in this conversation that for the longest time, people just felt that women weren't important, which is why
Right. They
have remained invisible in history. But you went to an all-girls school from kindergarten through 12th grade, and then you went to Wellesley.
Right.
Did they say nothing about these women in that whole long time,
you
that
know,
period?
Really not much, and I took a lot of history. I mean, what I knew Martha Washington spent a winter at Valley Forge. And by the way, children today don't seem to know that. I mean, when I ask them what do they know about Martha Washington, they say she was George Washington's wife and she was the first lady, which is correct, but there's nothing that she did, you know. I knew about Dolly Madison saving the portrait of George Washington. But that was really about all. And really, Mike, when I started this work, there were a few good biographies of Abigail Adams, because we do have so many of her letters.
Mm-hmm.
But since then, several quite good biographies have come out. There's a wonderful one on Dolly Madison called A Perfect Union. There's a very good Martha Washington one. There's a Peggy Shippen one that's out right now, just come out. There's the Jane Franklin one, Jane Franklin Meekham's just out this year. There's a Betsy Ross one that's very good that came out last year or the year before. So it's happening. These are coming. There's a brand new one on Elizabeth Bonaparte, who was a wild woman, and so it is. It's now happening. People are paying attention.
You started a trend.
I hope so.
Evidently, you mentioned that we have a lot of Abigail Adams letters, and I would imagine, correct me if I'm wrong, that's thanks in large part to John Adams.
It is, because she kept saying, "Burn my letters," because she was so frank, and he thankfully did not. And the Massachusetts Historical Society has just done an incredible job. They've got all of John and Abigail's letters to each other online, transcribed and online. And they're not annotated, but still, they're online, and so you can get to them. And then there is the Dolly Madison digital edition at the University of Virginia, which is incredible. It is all annotated letters to and from Dolly Madison with all kinds of references to the people and events in the letters. So you can learn an enormous amount of history going to that. But that's ongoing. It's you know, this all takes time and money.
That's Cokie Roberts, longtime NPR commentator and former political correspondent. She died yesterday. We'll have more of our conversation with her from 2014 in just a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. I'm Mike Collins. We're listening back to our conversation with Cokie Roberts about her book, Founding Mothers. Cokie Roberts died yesterday. We spoke to her several times over the years on Charlotte Talks about politics and women in American history. In 2014, we spoke about Founding Mothers. John Adams kept a lot of his wife's letters, all of his wife's letters, despite her admonition to burn them all. Why didn't other founding fathers? We know they wrote back and forth to each other. We know that they were separated by war and by the Continental Congress and other goings-on. Why didn't they all keep the letters? It seemed to be a habit of people back then to keep letters.
Well, that's true. Thomas Jefferson burned all of his wife's correspondence with him, and he said it was because he was so heartbroken when she died. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, I don't think that's what you do when you're heartbroken, but it's his story and he's sticking to it. So Martha Washington, we assume, burned all of her correspondence with George. And James Monroe burned all of his correspondence with Elizabeth Monroe. So I think that it was for a variety of reasons. I think that the women did it because they thought it was too personal. Mm-hmm. And also that they were embarrassed by their spelling and grammar and all of that. And the men did it because they thought it was too personal.
Yeah.
And that they said things to the women that they didn't say to anybody else. And that's, of course, what makes them so interesting. So I think that there was a real, you know, there was a conscious decision for some of these people to say, when we don't want others to read our mail. And then for some of the others, it was just, you know, who cares about these women? You know, so why would I bother to save it?
Hmm.
So the families just didn't take good care of it, that kind of thing.
Yeah, you mentioned the spelling, and even reading the Declaration of Independence is difficult because,
right.
Because as Stan Freberg points out in his comedy album about the early days of the United States, that all of the S's look like F's.
Perfoot
of happiness.
Right, exactly. But, now, reading these letters is very difficult if somebody hasn't transcribed them, because not only is the handwriting hard to decipher and some of the spelling and all of that, but they also wrote sideways and lengthways and on top and all that because paper was scarce.
Mm-hmm.
So I really can barely read most of them. I hire people who know. No, seriously, because I have a terrible time reading.
Yeah, and spelling. You mentioned spelling. Spelling wasn't standardized till the 19th century, was it?
No, that's right. And a lot of these women did not have a formal education, so that their spelling was very catch as catch can.
Now
I tell you, I just learned, Mike, just the other day, that Bess Truman burned all of her correspondence with Harry Truman, and that he came upon her doing this and was horrified. And he said, "Bess, what are you doing? Think of history." And she said, "I am. That's why I'm doing this."
You know, aside from your contemporary political connections to government, you are the child of a mother and father who served in Congress, and you have, I didn't know this till I read part of this book, that you have connections to the early days of the country. That would be William Claiborne, who actually knew the founding fathers.
Absolutely.
And who became an important person in the expansion of the country. Did he or any of his three wives help you and your family in your efforts by leaving behind some of their correspondence?
His correspondence I can pull up online. But I have nothing from any of his wives.
Hmm.
And that is really, His first wife, he was from Virginia originally and then ran for office from Tennessee. And his first wife was a Virginia girl, and they got to Louisiana, and she immediately came down with yellow fever or malaria or something, you know, something mosquito-borne, and died very quickly. And then he married again, and she didn't last long either. And then he finally married a Creole, and she had quite a life. But we don't have her correspondence.
The title of your children's book, Remembering the Ladies, comes from an admonition from Abigail Adams to John. She told him, "Remember the ladies." In what context did she make that statement?
Well, she had been militating for independence for at least a year before the founding fathers got up the courage to declare it. And as it became clear that they were finally moving in that direction, she said, well, I suppose you're going to have to write a new code of laws for our new country. And when you do, remember the ladies, because all men would be tyrants if they could. And John just laughed at her. He said, you know, he did the classic put down of, oh, you women really have all the power, which, of course, is not true. But that became a very famous saying, that when latter-day feminism reared its head in the 1970s, that was passed around by everybody to remember the ladies. I have to say, Mike, in talking about this book, the illustrations are fabulous. Diane Good, the illustrator, who is a Caldecott Medal winner, really got into this, and she, I think, has just done a remarkable job. They're funny and they're interesting, and she did a huge amount of research herself, and she got very interested in the women's handwriting, and her husband found her some antique nibs for quill pens.
Mm-hmm.
So she tried it herself with, you know, with old paper and ink, dipping the pen in the ink and writing and seeing how it splashed and all of that. And she lives in New Jersey, and then Hurricane Sandy hit, and she found herself without power for a couple of weeks. So she really felt that she was in communion with these women because she was writing as they were by candlelight, mm-hmm. or moving from room to room to catch the sun or get some warmth and all of that. So she really got into it and did a wonderful job.
Yeah, for people who can't see the pictures, they're characterized by very fluid lines, and they smack of the period, but with a little modernity thrown in there.
With humor.
Yeah, and also a little bit of Hirschfeld. I mean, he could have done some of these, I think.
Well, that's true. Well, because she did get it, she was very, because of the linear nature, which was sort of her way of mimicking the handwriting. She did at the last minute also say to me, do you think we could get all of their signatures?
Hmm.
And I said, boy, that's going to be hard because, you know, it's bad enough to get the letters, much less the original with the signature. But we did. We contacted the universities and historic societies, and we got each woman's signature. So under her picture is the way she actually signed her name. And I teased Diane that, you know, she did such a good job of it that she could be a counterfeiter in her next life.
That statement that she made, Abigail Adams made to John about remember the ladies later on, or maybe I would like to get the timeline of when these two statements were made. Remember the ladies, and something else that she wrote to John. You know, we women are really better patriots than you men are, because we are suffering all of the hardships and making all of the sacrifices for the cause. And if we win, you men will be held in high acclaim and hold office, and we won't even be able to vote.
Right.
Which came first? Do you know?
The Remember the Ladies came first.
Okay.
It was that was 1776, and it was as I say, as they were contemplating independence. So I think it was like winter or spring of 1776. We women are the best. That's not a direct quotation. The quotation is: patriotism in the female breast is the most disinterested of virtues, and then she does go on to say, we will not be able to, we are making the sacrifices, etc. And that was during the war, so I don't have the date in front of me, but it was probably around 1780.
So was his reaction to that dismissive as well?
No. He was quite the contrary. He was very respectful.
Hmm.
He normally was very respectful, and he would say to her, my dear, you are an heroine, and I don't know how you're going to exist even, and, you know, you are just remarkable, and you are, he said at one point, you are a leader of Amazons. I mean, no, he was normally very respectful of her, of what she was doing for the family, and also of her intelligence and and her acumen, because he had a political deaf ear, total.
Which is why he was a one-term president.
Right, that's one of the reasons. And he relied on her for political information and for political advice.
Mm-hmm. And she was very outspoken, you say.
Yes. In fact, when he was elected president, she was very concerned about how she would be able to hold her tongue. And he wrote to her and said, you know, women can hold their tongues if they want to. Well, she felt that maybe other women could, but she didn't think she could.
You mentioned Martha Washington. I think most of us do know, although you say children don't anymore, know much about Martha Washington's time at Valley Forge during that terrible winter. I know about it in one winter, but you say it was more than one winter. She spent a lot of time with George Washington and the Continental Army at a time, you say, when the soldiers were deserting in droves. She cajoled the troops, nursed their wounds, sewed them clothes, kept them from decamping, and you add that, something I don't think most of us know, I certainly didn't, that she protected the very attractive George from scandal, as he was prone to indiscretions like dancing the night away with Catherine Green, the wife of his fellow General Nathaniel Green. Where did you find that out?
Well, that's actually pretty well documented. Kitty Green, she was called different nicknames by different people, but she was this very flirty, wonderful young woman who loved going to camp with the soldiers. Martha, as you say, went every winter of the 8 long years of the Revolution, and she didn't love going because it was unpleasant and it was cold and there wasn't enough food, and she had to go over bad roads where she was subject to hostage taking and all of that, but she went because the general begged her to come to improve troop morale. Katie Green loved going because otherwise she'd have to stay home with her really boring in-laws in Rhode Island, and she hated that. And she had a good time at camp, but although she this is not in the children's book, but she fretted over it because she knew every time she went she'd get pregnant. And that did, in fact, happen. She, in fact, had one baby in camp.
The troops would proclaim that Lady Washington is here when she arrived, and they really liked her being there. Why?
First of all, she was just very nice to them. She would arrive with foodstuffs that had been preserved and pickled and smoked from Mount Vernon, and cloth that had been woven by the enslaved people there. This is, you know, one of the many contributions of African Americans to the cause. And she'd have a carriage full when she would come into camp. And so that was one great reason to hail her arrival. But then she would, as you said, she would cook for the soldiers and pray with the soldiers and nurse the soldiers and help the other officers' wives put on great entertainments for them to keep up troop morale. And they just loved her. There was one letter, again, this is in the grown-up book, of a soldier who was guarding her. And he said, you know, we all vie for this because we like her so much, but there are these members of Congress who come here, and they want to get in on the act, basically, and we don't like them one bit.
So now, what are there other things about George that we should know that we don't know?
Well, I think George was quite proper, but he did have an eye for the ladies. So when he took his two trips, when he was president, he took a southern tour and a northern tour and wrote about it in his diaries. And he always comments on the looks of the women in those accounts.
Martha Washington, you say, went to Valley Forge every year.
Went to camp every year.
Oh, okay, went to camp because the camp did move. Okay.
Right.
Every year for 8 years. And I don't know that. I didn't know that. Why don't we know that? That's a remarkable thing to do.
Well, not only did she do that, which was remarkable, particularly at the very end, because the war was over, but they had to keep some modicum of an army because the peace treaty hadn't been signed. Mm-hmm. And so you had to have the threat of going back to war if the negotiations fell apart. And so that was really hard. That was up... in New York, in West Point, and she was really having a hard time, you know, sort of encouraging people to plant gardens with her and all of that to just keep them there and occupied. But she also, after the first winter at camp in Cambridge, Massachusetts, she went to Philadelphia and took the smallpox inoculation, which was really scary. If you lived through it, you were likely not to get smallpox, but that was a big if. And Washington wanted his troops to take it because he didn't want them to have smallpox. And, of course, in that era, all the way up through World War One, more people died of disease than died of bullet wounds or any kind of weapons. And so she went and took the inoculation, much to George's surprise, and then he was able to say to the troops, well, look, the girl did it, you know. And so they then were much more ready to be vaccinated.
You know, the founding mothers are not just the famous people who were married to famous men. The founding mothers are all of the women who were part of that generation of people at the founding of the country, and many of them contributed in very special and very different ways.
Well, that's right. First of all, a lot of women went to war. Poor women couldn't stay home. There would be no way to support themselves. So they went with their children, in many cases, to war with the men as camp followers. And they did jobs for the Army. They did some cooking and some watering of the cannons and that kind of thing. And they were paid a tiny, tiny pittance, but they were paid. And then there were stories of great heroism where they took over the guns after their husbands were killed. The most famous of those is Margaret Corbin, who was at the Battle of Port Washington in New York and was injured three times after her husband was killed, and she took over his gun. And then she was disabled and did receive a congressional pension, which is the other way that we can learn about history, is from government records. Again, much harder for women, but there are some. And she's buried at West Point, you know, so she has been recognized as a contributing soldier. And then there were lots of female spies. Spying is kind of women's work. And their stories are quite courageous and valiant. And then there are women who, as I said earlier, were propagandists, like Mercy Otis Warren, writing plays and poems to encourage the Americans to rebel.
We'll bring you more of our conversation about founding mothers in just a moment with NPR's Cokie Roberts, who died yesterday. This is Charlotte Talks on WFAE. I'm Mike Collins. We're listening back to our 2014 conversation about the book Founding Mothers with longtime NPR commentator and former political correspondent Cokie Roberts. She died yesterday at the age of 75. Cokie Roberts from NPR is our guest, author of Founding Mothers, The Women Who Raised Our Nation. I'm sorry, Cokie, I've forgotten the second book.
Ladies of Liberty,
Ladies
the
of
Women Who Shaped Our Nation.
And then the book that just came out in February for children, Founding Mothers Remembering the Ladies, which is 37 pages long, if I counted correctly. And after having written so extensively about these women in the first several of your books, talk about the challenge of having to be so brief for younger readers.
Well, it was a challenge, but I'll tell you, Mike, and you can sympathize with this, it helped being a broadcast journalist because I have written one-minute news spots on very complicated things. Mm-hmm. I'm serious about that. You know, you do know how to condense a lot of very complicated information into short spaces.
If you get 37 seconds, you're lucky.
That's right. So this was the same kind of challenge. The children's book editors at HarperCollins were obviously much more experienced in this than I, which is to say nothing. But they were terrific. So it was their suggestion that I write one page of essentially, you know, sort of interesting biography, and then one page of vignettes, of tidbits that would be interesting for the children and illustratable from the women's lives. And then in addition to the 10 women whom we profile, we also have a timeline and a little interlude on women writers and a little interlude on women warriors. So there's a remarkable amount of information in here, given the fact that it is, you know, a 37-page book or whatever you said it was, 34 with conclusion. I have it in front of me. But there's still a lot in here. So I think that even grown-ups will find it educational.
So a lot of things had to hit the cutting room floor. So how did you choose the 10 women who you profile in this book?
Well, again, the publishers had pretty strong views about them. But I tried to get them from different parts of the country, and also we wanted to make very sure to include Phyllis Wheatley, who was a slave and a poet. And I'm encouraged by the fact that children seem to know more about her than some of these others. She was an incredible story. We forget that the sin of slavery, as Abigail Adams referred to it, was extant in all of the colonies before the war, and she was in Massachusetts. She had arrived by ship in the 1760s, probably about 7 or 8 years old, which we know because she still had her baby teeth. And she was hired by a family, or bought by a family, to do household chores. And they soon realized that she was incredibly smart, and she learned her English and reading and writing and arithmetic and the Bible. Then she moved on to Greek and Latin, and she started writing poetry when she was a teenager, and it was published. And then she wanted it published in a book, and nobody in America would do that. And the prominent men of Boston all wrote letters as testimonials to her, but also endorsements saying, you know, she did this, she really did do this, and sent the letters and the poems to London, where her book was published, and she became an overnight sensation, which also, by the way, Mike, I can't get over how fast news traveled back and forth, considering how long it took to get across the ocean. But like 6 weeks after Oliver Goldsmith's play opened in London and opened in New York. So, you know, you had things happening like that. And she became a celebrity on both sides of the ocean.
Wow. You start, and I think our listeners in South Carolina will be pleased to hear this, you start with a profile of Eliza Lucas Pinckney of South Carolina. I had heard of her husband, Charles, but never really of her. Why did you put her first?
Well, she's the oldest, among other things, but she was the mother of two very prominent statesmen, Thomas Pinckney and Charles Cotesworth Pinckney. But she was unbelievable. At the age of 16, her father left her in charge of three plantations in South Carolina. And the reason we have her writings is because she had to keep him apprised of the business. So she wrote to him regularly and kept a letter book, thank heavens.
Yes, she made copies of her letters.
Right.
Yes.
Because that was what one did for business purposes. And she was incredible. She always had some scheme going to make some money, to start a business, to educate the slaves, to do all kinds of things. But the thing she was most interested in doing was getting indigo, the indigo plant, which, of course, indigo was the dye used in all of the military uniforms in Europe. She wanted to get it going in the colonies. And she tried and failed and tried and failed, and she had a subversive overseer who was, you know, undermining her. And, of course, all the men in the South Carolina Low Country were just laughing at her, this girl trying to start indigo. And then she succeeded, and it became the biggest cash crop before the Revolution. One contemporaneous author said, you know, that it was more valuable to the colonies than gold was to Mexico, and she did it.
Wow. I want to remind people that she was running these three plantations and doing all of the things that you're talking about here, beginning at the age of 16.
And you, I know, and we don't even like turning over the car keys.
and you quote her in a letter that she was writing to, I guess, a friend in England. She says, "Lest you should imagine it too burdensome to a girl at my early time of life, give me leave to answer you. I assure you, I think myself happy that I can be useful to so good a father, and by rising very early, I find I can go through much business. Boy, does she, I mean, she sounds...
No, she was really something, and to show you that things don't change, the old ladies in the neighborhood kept saying to her, you know, you're way too smart for your own good. You'll never catch a husband. And one of them threatened to throw her copy of Plutarch's Lives into the fireplace. And then her father kept trying to marry her off because they were land rich but cash poor. And she absolutely refused to marry any of the people that he suggested, which in itself was unbelievable. Mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm. Girls didn't do that, didn't say no to their fathers. And she had this wonderful mentor, Charles Pinckney, and his wife. And just as her father was about to pack off the whole family and take them back to the island of Antigua, where he was, Charles Pinckney's wife had the good grace to die. And so he then married Eliza.
Did he allow her to continue with a similar set of responsibilities?
He was a great mentor to her. He was a big help to her.
She was important enough to the early days of the country that George Washington felt it necessary to act as a pallbearer at her funeral. Why then did her contributions fade into the mists of history?
Because she was a woman. I mean, it's just not that... she is known in South Carolina. I mean, I spend a lot of time in South Carolina, I'm happy to say, because we have a house on Pawleys Island. But so she is a well-known person in South Carolina. But I did not know about her, and I've gotten to know her well and really admire her incredibly. Because then, so she's back, and they went to England for a while, and then she's back in America for the Revolution. Her husband's dead. Her sons are getting taken prisoner by the British. The British burn down her plantation and her house in Charleston. She moves in with her daughter Harriet, to Hampton Plantation. And George Washington, actually, in that southern tour that I was talking about earlier, came to visit them because of her contributions and her sons. And in fact, he said, Harriet said to him, you know, we're going to cut down that tree there because it's blocking our view of the Waccamaw River. And he said, oh, don't cut down the tree. It's only God can make a tree. So it still stands, and
wow.
People get married under the Washington oak.
She, speaking of oaks, she planted a whole lot of oak trees because she had the, what's the word I'm looking for?
Foresight.
The foresight, thank you. to understand that if America was going to become a country, it would have to have a fleet of ships, and they would need oak for the ships.
isn't that remarkable? So
yes.
She did that, and then she started a silk project where she raised silkworms and wove the silk, and she made a couple of dresses, one of which went to the wife of the Prince of Wales, and then she kept one, and that dress still exists. It goes on tour every so often. We have no portrait of Eliza Pinckney, but we do have the dress.
Let's talk for a minute, not so much about Benjamin Franklin, who everybody knows because of the stove.
They know different things about him. I ask the children what they know, and they know about the kite.
Yes. But he was a philosopher, an inventor, a printer, a writer, a contributor to the Continental Congress.
Helped write the Declaration.
That's right. One of our early diplomats, etc. Turns out, though, he was a lousy husband.
And father.
And father.
Yes.
So describe what Deborah Reed Franklin did for him and, by extension, for the country.
Well, she was quite, I keep using the word remarkable, but it's true. So one of the things I learned in school was that Benjamin Franklin was the first Postmaster General of the United States. And when I say that now, the grown-ups all nod. The children don't seem to know that. But the grown-ups do all...
Well, they don't know what the mail is.
I guess that's right. I guess that's right. But, of course, he wasn't in the United States. He was in England. He was the lobbyist for the Pennsylvania colony before the British Parliament. And he was gone for years and years and years at a time. And Deborah Reed Franklin kept begging him to come home, but he wouldn't come home. He felt he had work to do in England, and he was having a wonderful time. And so she was left to run the Postal Service, which she did with great acumen, and she hired special horses and all of that. And at one point, the British noble, who was the titular head, tried to fire one of her workers, who was her cousin, and she got furious with him, and she told him off and told him, you know, that he was messing with the postal service and to butt out. And there is the most wonderful illustration of this with Deborah Franklin looking absolutely furious, holding out her hand, and Lord Loudon is standing as this little tiny figure in the palm of her hand. But also, and this is also wonderfully illustrated in the book, Ben's neighbors in Philadelphia felt that he had not been sufficiently adamant in his opposition to the Stamp Act, and they were furious with him and were ready to come burn down the house. And everybody said, Deborah, get out, you know, this is dangerous. And she, instead of getting out, she got a gun, and she got some relatives with guns, and she defended her house, saying, I had not given offense to any person at all, but if anyone come to disturb me, I would show them proper resentment at the end of a gun. And Franklin said, oh, that's terrific, Deborah. Well done. Carry on. But he refused to come home. And finally she died. And he said, well, I have to go home because my wife, in whose hands I have left the care of my affairs, has died. And so he went home. So I will admit that when he got home, he helped write the Declaration of Independence, and then he went to France and helped forge the alliance that won the war, but he was rotten to his wife and daughter.
From Deborah Franklin, let's spend some time talking about Deborah Sampson, who's pretty much unknown to most people, but she was in her own way extraordinary.
Well, she disguised herself as a man in order to fight in the war, and she made herself a uniform and called herself Robert Shirtliff, and she fought in many battles and was wounded twice, but she still volunteered for dangerous assignments, and then she became sick and had to go to the hospital, where a doctor discovered, wait, you're a woman, and so she was discharged from the army, but she was given, she was another one, she got a soldier's retirement pay, with the Congress saying that she showed an example of female heroism, fidelity, and courage. She then went on the lecture circuit and talked about her glorious exploits, and life was really never the same for her after the war. She loved being in the Army.
Dolly Madison, you have called the Jackie Kennedy of the Revolutionary War era. She was certainly a party thrower. What did you learn about her that you didn't know before you wrote these books?
Oh, a great deal. I mean, one of the things, Mike, that was so interesting to me was how very political these women were. They were just deep. Their letters are filled with politics, and the men consulted them on politics. But when it came to Dolly Madison, they also publicly recognized her her political maneuverings and skill, and that very much surprised me. She brought the country together at a time when it could have easily fallen apart. The partisanship that we see today existed then, but the country was way too young and way too fragile to sustain it. And she made people come together and sit down and have a meal together and drinks together and behave.
NPR's Cokie Roberts. She died yesterday at the age of 75. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.